the Sunday Night Health Show podcast. Tonight, we are talking monkeypox with Dr. Tomi Mitchell. And a picture is worth a thousand words, right? But what if that picture is wrong? Matt Johnson is a mental health advocate who explains the public scrutiny that first responders go through. And July 28th is World Hepatitis Day. Dr. Sophia Bartlett gives us the 411 on that. And what books are you reading right now? Find out why that is important in how it may make you to live longer. And are you plagued by constipation? Let's get moving, people. The Sunday Night Health Show podcast starts now. As I mentioned earlier at the start of the program, looks like monkeypox is upon us. And the World Health Organization has determined that it is a big issue. And joining me on the program to talk a little bit more about that is Dr. Tomi Mitchell. She is well versed in monkeypox, and she joins me on the line from Alberta. Good evening, Dr. Mitchell.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on the show tonight.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. You are an MD. You're all about wellness and performance, and you empower lawyers, doctors to live their best lives. And something that you have noticed, and maybe before the World Health Organization finally acknowledged monkeypox as a pandemic, finally it has met the criteria for being a pandemic, and you wrote a very interesting article. Tell me a little bit, your incredible work that you do. Tell me a little bit about your inspiration for writing this article that I actually saw on LinkedIn.
Yes. Well, number one, writing is my way of sharing my truth and what I see in the world without any political affiliation, any organizational affiliation. That's me being authentic. And quite frankly, the monkeypox situation has been going on for, it's been around for years, but it has spread to multiple countries where it was never seen before over 2 months ago, right? So we are talking about, by definition of a pandemic, this pandemic started more than just this weekend.
Started a while ago, and it is, and we're seeing cases of it. I've actually seen cases of it. I know people or patients who have been diagnosed with monkeypox, and initially it was thought to be COVID-19, in part because they started out with a fever. That was their initial symptom. But we're not really seeing fever, at least I'm not seeing too much fever in patients who have the BA5 subvariant of Omicron. I don't know about yourself, but it quickly turned into the rash and muscle aches, and then it was diagnosed as monkeypox.
Yes, exactly. This disease is evolving, and it's not sugar cookie cutter. Like, beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, they said, oh, you don't have a sore throat, you do have a sore throat, you don't have a runny nose, like, whatever. Like, it was so, like, really? But what we've learned over the past 2 years, you can have many symptoms, or you can have, like, next to zero symptoms with COVID, right? So it really varies. But really, back to your original question, why I wrote it was because I felt like we were doing this again. And I frequently comment when I publish articles on subjects that are really alarming. When I first heard our leaders in Canada say, the monkeypox has a low risk to Canada, we are not concerned, as I wrote in my article, my heart, I groaned. And then I also laughed because I was like, we're here again. Because that's the same thing we said about COVID, right? It
exactly.
was low risk, we'll be over in 2 weeks. It's not even going to come to Canada, it's in China. And I'm like, are you kidding me? We know how viruses spread in the science community. We don't need a PhD of epidemiology or virology to tell us that. And we fly as people. So the virus, you know, gets onto us humans, and then we travel. So we can be around the world in less than 24 hours. So how is
That's
this
right.
low risk? So let people, society, why don't we learn from the past? And it's not even that far away. Okay, the last major global pandemic was smallpox 100 years ago. And people are like, oh, that's so far away. Oh, my goodness, how are we supposed to know that? Like, whatever excuses. Okay, no, we are still in a COVID pandemic. It has not gone. We are ramping up with another variant of concern. Mm-hmm. And now we're here. And then to make matters worse, the messaging is it's only in men that have sex with men. As if mm-hmm. men that have sex with men are the only people that can contract monkeypox. There are studies of, I think it's the last study I read, was about 72 cases of children globally, and about 23 were under the age of 4. Okay?
That's right.
And that is reported cases. So we know that's an underestimate, just like with COVID. We know in many cases it's probably 10 times less or more. Like we're missing so many. So why is monkeypox any different? Why is it that we suddenly don't use common sense, principles of science that we've known for centuries? When are we going to learn? And that is why I wrote it, because it's like, let's do something different, world and Canada.
I could not agree with you more. What exactly is monkeypox? Let's just step it back a little bit.
Well, monkeypox is, it's a virus from the pox family. Like, we've all heard of chicken pox. And it's similar to that which causes smallpox, which we haven't as a society heard, like, seen. Like, I haven't seen smallpox. Maybe I haven't seen it in my clinical practice, but it's not related to chicken pox, okay? So it's like a virus. It looks like molestum, and we see that often in kids. And many parents could probably remember taking their kids when they went to clinics more often for like little treatments of liquid nitrogen to little raised lesions. And that's where it often starts. Huh. They're called molluscs. They get raised, white, pink. So pretty benign, because we see these in the office. I've done thousands of liquid nitrogen treatments or sent them off to dermatology to get treated. So that alone, because it can appear so benign, it might not be a differential diagnosis. And also because the messaging is it's for a certain demographic, which can lead to further stigma, which our world doesn't need, it gets ignored.
Absolutely. Getting back to that it's only in, or the messaging out there is that this only occurs in men who have sex with men. Typically, these viruses may start within a particular group, but quickly spread, as you already mentioned.
100%.
There are cases. Yeah. HIV is a great example.
Thank you. Exactly. Look, that was in the 80s when it like exploded in North America, then it really mattered, right? But it had been in other mm-hmm. countries, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We're going to go to break, Dr. Mitchell, but I'd like you to stay on the line. And when we come back, talk a little bit more about how monkeypox is spread and what the treatments are, and also the shocking mortality rates. I'm Maureen McGrath, and you're listening to the Sunday Night Health Show. Welcome back to the Sunday Night Health Show. Dr. Tomi Mitchell is my guest. She is an MD in wellness and performance specialist. She empowers lawyers, doctors, and other professionals to reduce burnout and overwhelm so that they can increase productivity in the workplace. She's leverage-based leadership. She's a speaker, trainer, and a writer. And she wrote a very impactful article on, or posted it on LinkedIn, about monkeypox. Have we learned anything? Thanks for staying on the line, Dr. Mitchell.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Is monkeypox easy to get, and how do people contract monkeypox?
Well, the messaging right now, it's not easy to get, right? And that was the same messaging we had with COVID, but it's very easy to contract COVID. You were definitely talking about close contact with an affected person, but even objects that they came in contact with, such as bedding. And again, I do need to triple check resources, but we're hearing stories about the potential of monkeypox being aerosol, being in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's right.
It's not, so here we go again, right? So it's like
exactly.
By breathing, you can contract it, right? So that's where we are. And the fact is, as a society, sometimes transparency when it comes to emerging illnesses that are evolving is limited. And the response, as in when they share this information with us, can be significantly delayed. And this is typical of what we've seen. Yes, it's concerned about patient privacy, which I totally respect and understand that. But we need data. We need to know what is happening so parents, families, communities, schools can make informed choices. Like, summer is going to be over in a few weeks, unfortunately, or a month or two. Kids are going to be going back to school. We know that this potentially can spread in ventilation systems. And we know that as a whole, we didn't do a good job in changing ventilation systems with COVID. So now we have two pandemics, right, that have varying presentations. Right? And the pox, you don't have to have a skin lesion. You don't have to have a skin lesion. It's only about 70% have the skin lesion.
Uh-huh. So I know that monkeypox can be severe and even deadly in some people, and people can become sick for 2 to 4 weeks, which can impact their jobs, their relationships, their quality of life. It is really to be, it's a tremendous concern for Canadians. What does Canada need to do to get the monkeypox outbreak under control?
Okay, so we need to work on a national level and global. So nationally, we need to do what we know that's been the science books for hundreds of years. Early contact tracing, isolation, testing, vigorous testing, accessibility testing. Every doctor's office should be armed with a, you know, swab, whatever, and trained. Like, this is what to look out for. There should be drive-through centers that are open to those who choose want to get vaccinated, right? But tracing is key.
Doctors need to be educated. You make a great point. Doctors need to be educated.
But they're not.
This.
But most are not.
They're not.
Exactly.
Right. There really needs, we need to scale up that program in this country to educate doctors about what to look for.
And the sad thing is we already have a doctor shortage crisis, which our governments as a whole, I don't know what they're doing, right? What is the Canada-wide response to this and provincial-wide? So we have a crisis on a crisis. We have a healthcare worker crisis. So we have less doctors, less nurses, people who are already exhausted, okay, from burnout.
That's right.
Right? Now it's like, here's another pandemic. Most people are not enthusiastic about this, but the virus doesn't
100%.
Care.
That's right. There was an article. No, it doesn't. And people are despondent almost about COVID-19 and the continuing pandemic. There was an article in New York Times, and they said that, you know, New Yorkers' attitude about COVID-19 was meh. And that's pretty much the world's attitude about COVID-19 that we're having that. Dr. Mitchell, I really appreciate you coming on the program tonight, especially on such short notice. Your article was on LinkedIn. Where else can people, you know, find out about you or get more information?
For sure. So your article was originally posted Kevin MD, and you saw it on LinkedIn, and maybe other people saw it on Twitter. They can reach me by searching Dr. Tony Mitchell, whether Instagram, Dr. Tony with an M Mitchell, or LinkedIn. Those are my two most popular sites. So
thank,
you can DM
thank you
me.
Thank you so much.
Open air.
A few weeks back, there was yet another tragic school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. There was a lot of public scrutiny of the response or lack of response of the police officers while many children and teachers lay sick, injured, and dying. It took the police officers what seems to be over an hour to respond. There was a photograph of one particular first responder who was seemed to be looking at his phone within minutes of entering the school as other police officers were milling about. This, to the public, seems absolutely horrific, and many people took to Twitter to express their outrage and upset over this photo. A picture is worth a thousand words, but sometimes those words might be wrong. Joining me on the line is Matt Johnson. He is a firefighter and a mental health professional. Good evening, Matt. How are you?
Great, Maureen. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for asking. So looking back to this, I know you do a lot of work with first responders around their mental health, because this is a massive issue for people attending tragic events like the Uvalde mass shooting or even the bank robbery we had in Victoria, British Columbia, Saanich, British Columbia recently. And, you know, it's horrific. I know myself, I've attended emergency situations and, you know, I've had nightmares afterward, talking in my sleep, you know, had to talk it out. And it can be just horrific and really can impact the quality of life of a person. But nothing is worse than when you are publicly scrutinized for something that you may or may not have done. And I referred to the photograph of the police officer who many people know because social media takes care of that. Somebody doesn't know, put it on Twitter and everybody knows. Of a police officer who had the Punisher logo, number one, on his phone, and then also was seemingly not responding within minutes of entering the school. You know, to be honest, a lot of word has come out now that the officers waited an hour before tending to the people who had been shot. But this particular police officer, that picture may not be exactly accurate. What is your knowledge on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite fascinating because we're in an era where you just never know what the true details are of an event. But ironically, I was flipping through the channels and came across CNN and they were apologizing or seemingly apologetic regarding new details that came to light regarding this officer that was on his phone during the school shooting. And the truth that's behind the matter, as far as I've been able to research, is that his wife was a teacher at the school, and she had actually been shot. And to my knowledge, he was checking his phone to see if she was had texted or contacted him. So, you know, this is a very rare, tragic situation where not only is a first responder responding to an emergency event, but he's responding to an event that involves a family member, which is something that I wish upon no first responder. You're right. I do a lot of work with first responders. I am a full-time professional firefighter. And I think, you know, in my 10 plus years in this profession, I've realized that when you compound the significance of the event from a personalized perspective, like this is an extreme example, just the compounded weight that's placed on your shoulders and the complex trauma that you experience afterwards, that in this case, you know, obviously became magnified through being vilified by the public. And this is something that obviously few people will ever be able to relate to in society. It looked bad by the picture that's described, but in reality, there's a very different story that's to be told here.
Absolutely. I mean, my heart goes out to this gentleman. If that is the case, I, to be honest with you, I hadn't heard that. But you know, I also wonder if that is true, and I'm going to believe you, of course. is somebody, do they even notice that they're being publicly vilified? I mean, if you're, wife lays dying, are your thoughts and attention to that, and do you know people actually care what other people think about that? Does that make the tragedy that much worse, or is the focus with family and on, you know, grief and trying to get through such a tragedy?
Yeah, it's a great question. Fortunately, I've never been in this situation. I can tell you that one of the most memorable calls I went to was a call that reminded me of my mother, and this lady likely survived. But when I went into her home, she had the same bedroom set as my mom. She lived alone. She had a very clean home. And when I went to retrieve her personal health number, I felt like I was responding to my mom. And so it's amazing how you can manufacture that connection at a scene, but to have it actually be a family member is a situation that I think is very rare in large urban centers. And, you know, we have to think about our first responders in smaller rural communities where, you know, responding to friends and family might be something they do multiple times throughout their career.
Absolutely. I would imagine that it was something that could happen. You know, a policeman and a teacher, you know, often end up together or work like that in communities, and, you know, nurses and doctors, for example, and, you know, family members can come into emergency departments. And I would imagine that it does happen, you know, quite often, you know, more than we would think. I know that I've been in situations, I mean, not exactly like that, but where you've gone in, you are, you know, in action, resuscitating somebody. And I remember once in my career, I was in a labor and delivery unit, and none of the nurses really had done resuscitation or knew how to use the equipment. And I had worked in the ICU, and so I just went, I was the manager, but I actually went into action and, you know, ran the code with the physician. And I was actually even doing my own recording, taking notes, because a lot of the nurses, my memory is that a lot of the nurses stood around stunned and couldn't actually move or do anything. Mm-hmm. And it was a pregnant woman who had a respiratory arrest, and they delivered the baby, resuscitated her. And I dropped the piece of paper that I was taking notes on. And in my haste, I said, "Would somebody please pick up my paper of notes?" And later on, the director of nursing said to me, she said, "I thought it was very unprofessional that you dropped your notes during that code." And I thought, are you kidding me? Like, I saved that woman's life. And not only that, and, you know, the nurses were, you know, very grateful. And, you know, I thought, that's what you have to say to me? You know, are you on crack? Like, what is like, and so it does, I can see where it would affect somebody, you know. Here I was, you know, that first responder, if you will. And then, you know, criticized for something that was out of my control, actually. And quite frankly, didn't make one bit of difference.
And, you know, nursing, nursing is just like, you know, frontline public safety in a different context. The patients are coming to you rather than you going to the patients. And, you know, to your colleagues that froze in that moment, I know I've been on emergency scenes where that's happened too. And, you know, that's where the intensity and the confusion of the event is so significant that your mind and body kick in, and to normalize that, you know, it's to be human. And it takes one person on that scene to take a controlled perspective and engage, like we're trained to do, like you described yourself, to be involved. And sometimes, you know, what we find in public safety is the people that are taking those initiatives often experience the recourse that you did, which essentially becomes more of a moral injury, more of a, you know, a trauma that happens from an organizational standpoint of maybe not following protocols or conduct protocols, so to speak, right? It's a very common and often overlooked area when it comes to understanding the nature of the trauma that, you know, nurses, healthcare workers, and first responders face on the front lines every day.
That's exactly right. And I think in, you know, in a lot of even work that I do, you know, people can be critical of other people, you know, and that's the automatic response, it seems. You know, my world moves fast, you know, in some of the work that I do as well in healthcare, some of the consulting work that I do. And, you know, you need information, you need it quickly, and people panic, and people, you know, they get upset, and they, you know, is it time that we are kinder, a kinder nation to our healthcare providers? They're becoming fewer and fewer, and also our first responders. You know, your article on LinkedIn that you wrote was, you know, really a friendly reminder to be kind to first responders. They're performing work that many of the critics would never consider doing.
Well, and what I find fascinating about that, Maureen, is that that post, you know, got about 14,000 hits in a week and 25 comments. And what I found really interesting is the level of skepticism that people within public safety and often people in positions of administrative and consultancy roles that were questioning my source, that were questioning the tactics of the police officer, which I really wasn't commenting on. I was commenting on society's reaction to quickly vilifying first responders, not anything to do with protocols. I'm not a police officer. But what I found really interesting about it is people tying this to potentially, you know, the author having political ties to certain parties. And I was just like, we're in an era of sure misinformation, but I was pretty confident in cross-referencing two or three sources before I put that post out. And even doing that, I found that people were quite skeptical of my post, quoting me in terms of saying moving preemptively. Well, what does that mean, preemptively, you know? So there's really nothing you can do on social media now that will placate everyone. That's what I've learned from this post, is a friendly reminder to be kind to first responders turned into people, you know, criticizing not only his actions and the author's story and also me posting it. And it's like, when does this criticism kind of stop so that we can get down to the heart of the matter, which is how we treat our frontline emergency service workers in our culture and society, because that's really what the spirit of that post was intended to do.
That's right. And probably the person who took that photograph did it with intention, with the intention of, look at this, because the photograph, it doesn't look good when you look at it, to be honest with you.
No.
It's a, you know, a police officer with his gun sort of hanging, and he's looking at his phone, and he's got this Punisher logo on there, and he looks lackadaisical. And so, you know, as people, we don't slow down to actually find out what's the real story. We want to vilify people, it seems. We want other people to fail, or some people want other people to fail, you know, maybe to look better themselves. I mean, I always think that's one reason that we're happy when other people fail or make a mistake. But, you know, our mistakes are our greatest learning lessons.
Well, and,
but
yeah, absolutely, Maureen. And since we last spoke, I mean, I took my family on a road trip down to Eugene for the World Track Championships, and we stopped in Portland in the downtown core to go to a Nike store that I used to visit as a teenager. And the entire downtown core has been overrun by issues that we face in the downtown east side here in Vancouver, but to a much greater extent. Like, there's a 20-foot barrier to get into the Apple store. There's graffiti on, like, the 25th floor of a tower. And I really sat there kind of wondering, how would someone ever want to go into policing to deal with these complex issues that really is doing the heavy lifting of society, right? And I really feel for the men and women that wear the dark blues with policing, because it's a very tough job. You rarely only hear about the shortcomings of a police officer's actions. That's all you really hear about, rather than the positive contributions they make to the community. And I'm on a fancy fire truck. Every kid wants to be near it. People look at us as helpers. I'd love to see that as being the case for our police as well.
I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you so much, Matt, for joining the program tonight and for your friendly reminder to be kind to our first responders. It's never been so necessary. Really appreciate all of your great work and your contribution to the show.
Thank you, Maureen.
Welcome back to the Sunday Night Health Show. Are you a bookworm? If you are, that seems to be good news, according to a new study in the journal Social Science and Medicine, because that study revealed that people who read books live longer than people who don't. The research was done at Yale University. There was around 3,600 participants over the age of 50, and they were asked survey questions about their reading habits. They split the cohorts into three groups. There were non-readers, readers who read less than 3.5 hours per week, and people who read more than 3.5 hours per week. And each group was followed for 12 years. And guess what? It is ladies' night here, and I just want to point out that the people who read the most were college-educated women in the higher income group. Now, they may have a little bit more time on their hands. Maybe, maybe not. But over the course of the study, the researchers consistently found that both groups of readers lived longer than the non-readers. And those who read over 3.5 hours a week lived a full, wait for it, 23 months longer than the people who didn't read at all. And it's important what you read. Book readers had a 4-month survival advantage at the age when 20% of their peers passed away. So it was noted that it's best to read books. And the reason it's best to read books like novels, for example, because reading involves two major cognitive processes, deep reading and emotional connection. And deep reading is that slow process where you engage with the book and you try to understand it within its own context and within the context of the outside world. And then you also have this emotional connection where you empathize with the character. So you're very much connected to the book, and that promotes social perception and also emotional intelligence. And so those cognitive processes were what was cited by the Yale team and used as markers for the study. So a couple of book suggestions that I have for you that I've read this summer so far, and the summer's not over yet. City on Fire by Garth Risk-Hallberg is one of them. I actually reread To Kill a Mockingbird because there's very few books that I reread because I don't like to do that. I don't like to watch movies twice, but that one I probably have read 10 or 15 times. I also read The Last Thing He Told Me by Laura Dave. I read The Lincoln Highway by Amor Towles. And it's probably not just this summer. This is in the last 3 or 4 months. The End of Normal, that was by Stephanie Madoff, Bernie Madoff's daughter-in-law. So those are some suggestions that I have. And Where the Crawdads Sing is on my list next. But right now, we are joined on the line by Dr. Sophia Bartlett. She's an epidemiologist and public health researcher based in Vancouver, Canada. She is the senior scientist for sexually transmitted and bloodborne infections at the British Columbia Center for Disease Control. She leads a program of research that aims to improve health equity for people who have experienced incarceration and people who inject drugs, which are two groups who are disproportionately impacted by sexually transmitted and bloodborne infections, STBBIs. She is also a surfer, a swimmer, a biker, and all-around athlete, it looks like. Hello, Sophia.
Hi, Maureen. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Pretty good. Yeah, I was out biking today.
Yes, and I was on your website, and your picture is incredibly impressive of you paddleboarding. I'm a paddleboarder, but not quite like that.
I didn't get to do as much surfing since I moved to Canada. I surfed a lot when I lived in Australia, but I get over to Vancouver Island whenever I can.
So are you surfing in that picture?
Yeah,
you paddle.
Yeah.
Oh, you surf. You surf with paddle.
Yeah, paddleboard surfing.
Oh, paddleboard surfing. Oh my gosh. Mm. Okay, that's a new one for me. Anyway, I'm a paddleboarder, and I was recently paddleboarding with some people who had never paddleboarded before, and they were calling me a monster in a good way.
It's always fun the first time, I think, especially.
Yes. Well, I've been doing it for a few years, but I could do it. I could get up on nobody I was with could get up on the board. They couldn't paddle. But I mean, it was on a lake. It was flat water, let me tell you. But anyway, yes, I will not be paddleboard surfing anytime soon. But thank you for doing that. And thank you, Dr. Bartlett, for joining the program. We're talking about World Hepatitis Day coming up on July 28th. Why is it important to have World Hepatitis Day?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So this is a day that's marked around the world to raise awareness about viral hepatitis. So that's primarily hepatitis B and hepatitis C. And that's because these are viruses which actually infect quite a lot of people around the world. And Canada is no different. We have quite a number of people estimated to be living with hepatitis C across Canada. We estimate there's about 58,000 people in British Columbia with hepatitis C infection or who have ever had a hepatitis C infection. And across Canada, the Public Health Agency releases estimates every year of how many new cases there are. And interestingly, because of COVID-19, the number of people getting tested for hepatitis C decreased quite a lot. And so we saw fewer diagnoses. And this is really concerning because we don't think that the number of new cases dropped off. It's just fewer people actually got diagnosed. And so this year, especially, World Hepatitis Day is really important because we want to try and make sure that those people who might have acquired the infection over the past couple of years or who already had the infection and weren't aware of it, will think about going out and getting tested so that they know what their hepatitis status is, because these are infections which actually have very few symptoms during the sort of chronic phase of the infection. Many people might notice sort of very vague things like feeling a bit tired or having, you know, sort of a little bit of, you know, joint pain, things like that. But they're things you can easily dismiss or kind of just think, well, maybe I'm getting older or maybe I'm tired. The only really sure way to know if you have a hepatitis infection, hepatitis B or hepatitis C, is to get tested.
And there are treatments for people. Is it, do people, it's very, very interesting that people have, getting delayed diagnoses. Many people have decided not to go to hospitals. So we saw that early on in the pandemic, or not to go to the doctor for fear of catching COVID-19, but a lot of other diseases were missed, and hepatitis is one of them. So, but also I think people are afraid to get diagnosed because they're afraid they're going to die or that it's going to be cancer or, you know, and they don't want to know.
But and I think there was a lot of kind of misunderstanding. So these viruses, hepatitis C especially, it's actually only really identified fairly recently. We only pinpointed that this was the virus that was causing what at that time we called non-A and non-B hepatitis in 1992 is when we actually got the screening tests to be able to test blood and know that that virus was present. And at that time, we didn't know a lot about hepatitis C. And that was when, you know, the AIDS epidemic was still really quite serious. There wasn't effective treatments for HIV back then. And so there was kind of a misunderstanding that hepatitis C was going to be something like HIV and that it was a death sentence. And at that time as well, there wasn't really any treatments available for hepatitis C. Those treatments kind of evolved over time. Throughout most of the 90s and into the 2000s, there was treatment that was available, but it took up to 48 weeks to complete the treatment and involved injections. And it was really quite kind of exhausting treatment to go through. It was interferon-based treatment, which we still use for other some other kind of health issues. However, at that time, the hepatitis C treatment with interferon was like kind of having the flu for 48 weeks. It was really something that people didn't enjoy going through, and it wasn't very effective. It was about 50% of people actually cleared the virus through that treatment. However, in about, I think it was 2017 in Canada, these new treatments were launched, and they've been launched around the world now. They're called directly acting antivirals. So these are antiviral medications. They're oral, so that means it's just a tablet that you swallow. There's no injections anymore. And the amazing thing about these medications is actually they're so targeted to the virus that they have very few side effects. So when people were taking this medication, they're actually not often feeling that unwell. And the other amazing thing is that because they're so potent, so they're very strong antivirals, the treatment is quite short now. So for most people with a hepatitis C infection, treatment is between 8 and 12 weeks, and it's just one to three tablets per day for that 8 to 12 weeks. And at that time, more than 95% of people who complete the treatment will be cured of the virus. It's actually one of the few chronic viral infections that is curable.
That is tremendous progress, and that's amazing. Now, I want to mention the website, worldhepatitisday.org. I Can't Wait is the new campaign theme to launch World Hepatitis Day this year, and that highlights the need to accelerate that fight against viral hepatitis and the importance of testing and treatment for the people who need it. It's a very informative website. I suggest listeners, you go to the website, worldhepatitisday.org, to learn. I learned so much in my brief time that I spent there. One was that hepatitis is the leading cause of liver cancer, and getting tested is the best way to protect yourself. You know, I find it counterintuitive that people are afraid to go to a doctor for fear of a cancer diagnosis, yet getting a hepatitis diagnosis and getting treatment can actually prevent cancer.
Absolutely true. So one of the most amazing things I think about hepatitis B treatment is that it effectively prevents cancer. We now know that there's quite a few cancers that are actually quite prevalent that are essentially caused by viruses. So the virus that infects us is essentially causing damage to the DNA in our cells, and then that cellular damage is accumulating and that results in cancer. And that's correct. So hepatitis C infection and hepatitis B infection are leading causes of liver cancer around the world, especially in Canada. And in fact, we can even see a reduced odds in developing cancer, even when someone is having hepatitis C treatment when they've already had damage to their liver. So for people who have even had that infection for 20 years or 30 years, where we've seen some of that cirrhosis develop in the liver, so that's where you have got scar tissue that's formed and your liver's starting to not function as well as it should. Even when people are having hepatitis C treatment at that time, we still see a very significant reduction in the risk of them developing liver cancer. And that's because our livers can heal. They're one of the few parts of our body that can regenerate and regrow. So once the virus is eradicated and the infection's gone, our liver starts to actually heal straight away. And so even for someone who might have known that they had hepatitis C infection for a long time, it's really never too late to connect with healthcare and ask about hepatitis C treatment. It's always going to be something that's beneficial. And of course, a hepatitis C diagnosis is going to be much easier to deal with than a cancer diagnosis at that point.
100%. I couldn't agree with you more. So the message here is don't wait, get tested, because you can't wait. And that, again, is the new campaign theme that is launching World Hepatitis Day 2022. Go to worldhepatitisday.org to learn more information. And Dr. Bartlett, there are ways that people can join the campaign. How could people, what's one great way for people to get involved?
Yes, so on the World Hepatitis Day org, worldhepatitisday.org website, there's quite a few of these, what they're calling 1-minute actions. So people can create their own pledge to end hepatitis. If you're not someone who is affected by hepatitis, one of the things that you can do is pledge to not stigmatize people. So we call it person first language. So when we're talking about people who are affected by hepatitis, saying the people first rather than hepatitis sufferers, for example, by putting the person at the front of the disease, we're making sure that we remember people's humanity. And that's one of the ways that we can combat stigma and discrimination that's often experienced by people who are living with these viruses or who are affected by them. And, you know, if it's something that might be potentially something that you think that you could have become exposed to. So, you know, if you had a tattoo a long time ago, that's a risk for hepatitis C. If you had any medical procedures in countries outside of Canada, for example, in countries that have high prevalence of hepatitis C, so China, Vietnam, Pakistan, India, if you had dental surgery in any of those countries, you could have been exposed to hepatitis C. And knowing what your hepatitis C status is really, really important. So, you know, if that's something that you think might be a possibility for you, then talk to your family doctor or look up on the Action Hepatitis Canada website. There's a network of organisations across Canada that support people living with hepatitis C, and they can give you information about how you can get tested and link with care wherever you live.
That's excellent information and so important, especially with a person dying every 30 seconds from a hepatitis-related illness. As I said from the website, I can't wait. The new campaign theme to launch World Hepatitis Day 2022. Dr. Bartlett, thank you so much for joining me and for all of the great information, and good luck on July 28th, World Hepatitis Day.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Welcome back to the show. Just quickly, we don't have too much time right now, but I want to talk about some research that has been done recently in Canada. We found that people with no dementia risk factors like smoking, diabetes, or even hearing loss have similar brain health as individuals 10 to 20 years younger. This is incredible news because these are some of the things that you can modify to actually improve your health. So you can manage your diabetes, address your hearing loss, go get your hearing assessed, and perhaps get hearing aids if you need them, and then also try and get the support that you need to quit smoking. There are a number of modifiable risk factors for dementia, such as low education. Less than a high school diploma is a contributing factor to an increased risk of dementia, traumatic brain injury, alcohol or substance use and abuse, hypertension, smoking in the past 4 years and currently as well, and also diabetes and depression. So there are things that you can do to change those to improve your quality of life and improve your brain health. And this is exciting news, especially for baby boomers. It is never too late to make those changes. The scientists in this research found that having three risk factors, for example, could decrease cognitive performance by as much as 9 years of aging. And the effects of the risk factors increased with age, as did the number of risk factors that people had. So a lot of people will have hypertension, diabetes type 2, for example, and they may smoke. And so those people are actually going to have brain cognition function that is a decade beneath where they should be. And they are at much greater risk. And those are three things that people can turn around. They can turn that around through diet, exercise. I've talked many, many times about my all-in diet that I'm happy to email to you if you like. Just email me, nursetalk@hotmail.com, and I'll send that off to you. Getting out there, getting exercise, quitting smoking, cutting down on your substance abuse. Older adults, 66 to 89, had more risk factors than middle-aged adults between the ages of 45 and 65, and younger adults had the least, of course, 18 to 44. And in fact, most young and middle-aged adults had no risk factors, 58% and 46% respectively, whereas most older adults had one risk factor. If you have any of these risk factors, may I suggest you work with your doctor to turn this issue around. Start addressing any risk factors you have now, whether you are 18 or 80, and you will support your brain health to help yourself age like a rock star. As you know, I see a lot of patients who are in sexless marriages. I did a TEDx talk on the subject about 5 years ago. It's had close to 32 million views, even after they told me that nobody would watch the talk. They said it was too long, and I needed to cut it in half. Ye who misjudged the attention span of people when we're talking about sexlessness. But that's true. They did ask me to cut it in half. And so I put it on these are my technological skills at work here. I put it on a drive that I shared with a physician that I was working on a project with. And so he texted me, he said, I watched your TEDx talk. Said, how did you do that? Anyway, he said, you put it on our shared drive. I wanted to put the original on because I was thinking about whether I should cut it in half, as they said. It was actually 24 minutes. And so they wanted me to bring it down to 12. It ended up being 22 minutes. And so I said, well, you know, the TEDx people want me to cut it in half. And he said, you want to please the TEDx people? Cut it in half. You want to please the world? Leave it exactly the way it is. And so I took the doctor's good advice and I kept it pretty much exactly the way it was. I guess I cut out a few extra things that I might have said, twice and brought it down to 22 minutes. And nonetheless, it has had close to 32 million views. It's a subject that a lot of people don't talk about. I remember when I was invited to give that TEDx talk, I actually declined at first because they sent me an application form and they invited me to speak. And then they sent me this application form and I thought, forget it. I will give 150% here and I will not be chosen. So I told them that. I said, I can't do it. I just don't have any time to fill out this application form. And they said, okay, forget filling out the form. Just do it. I'm like, okay, which was hence the talk that I gave, just do it. Anyway, so, which was the advice basically of the TEDx talk. But so I remember when I was speaking to this room, my memory serves me correctly. It was a room full of men. Anyway, and so I said, you know, they said, what are you going to talk about? And then I said, well, I thought I would talk about what I've been seeing in my clinical practice for the past, at that time, maybe 7 or 8 years. And I said, the sexless marriage. And they were all a little bit dumbfounded. I said, you know, I'm pretty much going to be letting the cat out of the bag here. People think that, oh, once you get married, you know, you just have sex all the time. You're able to have sex. But lo and behold, that is not the case, as we have learned, and perhaps you have learned as well. Ye who is married out there, perhaps your partner has low sexual desire, whether it be male or female. Women tend to have cornered the market on this because they have about 38.7% of women experience low sexual desire. And the biggest thing is that only 12% are bothered by it. About 20% of men experience low sexual desire, but it's almost worse when a female is in a relationship with a male and her male partner doesn't want or desire her sexually, because the conventional wisdom is that all men want is sex. Well, if all men want sex, a woman might think, why doesn't my man want me? What is wrong with me? And they internalize it and feel like they are not good enough, or they're not pretty enough, they're not thin enough. But actually the problem lies with the person, and often can lie with the sexual response cycle. It can be related to the sexual response cycle, or it can be like many couples that I see in my clinical practice of late. And that is, it appears to be chronic busyness and fatigue. And fatigue is the number one reason for low sexual desire. But if you look beneath the chronic busyness, everything perfect, the house is perfectly clean, people working inside and outside of the home, everything looks great. The incomes are high. The kids are in a million different activities. They're going from dusk until dawn. And then, you know, at the end of the day, people flop into bed and they have no time for each other. But what I've seen lately in my clinical practice is a rash of adult children of alcoholics who are in sexless marriages. And there is a great book, speaking of books, called it's called Adult Children of Alcoholics by the author is it's Janice Warwitz. And it defines the 13 characteristics of adult children of alcoholics, one or two, which is anxiety and depression and super responsibility or no responsibility. It can go one way or the other. Difficulty with intimate relationships as well. And oftentimes, this is what lies beneath the sexless marriages. This is what lies beneath the sheets. And people will take a look at the book and realize, or when I talk to them about the 13 characteristics of adult children of alcoholics, like guessing at what normal behavior is, having difficulty with intimate relationships, as I said, overachievers, perfectionism, you know, they will recognize that in themselves. And then when they read this book, which is not a very big book, but a very important book to read if you are in a relationship with somebody who was raised by an alcoholic or in another type of a dysfunctional family. And so you actually have to address that. And also so many of these people tell me that they've been to a sex therapist or they've been to marriage counselor. And the advice that they have been given is, you know, go to a cabin on a lake and, you know, surely you'll have sex then. Or you just might sleep the entire weekend because you're exhausted. And as I mentioned, fatigue is the number one reason for low sexual desire. And also lack of education is another reason around the sexual response cycle. But, you know, there can be substance use is another reason for low sexual desire as well. There can be many reasons, or anger, control issues, financial issues. There are so many different issues. Anyway, you can always Google TEDx Maureen McGrath, and if you want to go. But the best part of the TEDx talk was the 20,000 comments that are absolutely hilarious. If you don't really feel like listening to the TEDx talk, read the comments. I suggest you do that because that's the best. Anyway, getting back to the sexual response cycle, it refers to the sequence of physical and emotional changes that occur as you become sexually aroused and engage in sexually stimulating activities such as masturbation or intercourse, for example. And it's important to know and understand how your body responds during each phase of the cycle, because that can help to enhance your relationship and help you to pinpoint the cause of any problems that may be related to the sexual response cycle. So the basic linear model has four phases: excitement, plateau, orgasm, and resolution. Often it is thought that desire comes first, but desire doesn't necessarily come first. Arousal, in fact, may come first, and desire may come second. After a time with the same person, that applies because sexual desire wanes after being in a relationship with somebody after around 2 to 4 years. The same hormones are not excreted in the same amount. And of course, it becomes commonplace. It's like having vanilla ice cream every night. Both men and women experience these four phases of the sexual response cycle, although the timing is typically different. And it's very unlikely that both partners will reach orgasm at the same time ever. And the intensity of the response and the time spent in each phase is also a variable, and it varies from person to person. It may not be the exact same with you and your partner, or you and perhaps if you're in a threesome, it's not going to be the same for the three of you. And to understand these differences helps partners better understand others' bodies and responses, and that too can enhance your sexual experience. So excitement basically involves that time when the muscle tension increases, your heart rate quickens, your breathing is accelerated, you may become flushed, the nipples become hardened or erect. This can last for a few minutes to several hours. You get blood flow to the genitals. Well, it increases because blood flows to the genitals, newsflash, but that blood flow increases, and that results in the swelling of a woman's clitoris and labia and the erection of a man's penis. Vaginal lubrication begins. Some women have issues with vaginal lubrication, so there's treatment for that. And so if you experience that, that's something to understand, that this is an issue in the phase one, or the excitement phase, of the female sexual response cycle. A woman's breasts will become fuller and the vaginal walls will begin to swell. And for a man, the testicles swell, the scrotum tightens, and they begin secreting a lubricating liquid. Phase two, or the plateau, intensifies those changes that began in phase one. The vagina continues to swell from the blood flow. The clitoris becomes highly sensitive. It might even be painful to touch, and it will retract under the clitoral hood to avoid direct stimulation from the penis. And the man's testicles tighten. Of course, the breathing, the heart rate, and the blood pressure continue to increase, and some people may experience muscle spasms that begin in the feet, in the hands, and of course we get that muscle tension. And then phase three is orgasm, and the orgasm is the climax of the sexual response cycle. It's the shortest of the phases, and generally lasts only a few seconds, but it can last a little bit longer. You may experience involuntary muscle contractions. Your blood pressure, heart rate, and breathing are at their highest rates, and you have a rapid intake of oxygen at this point. You might experience muscle spasms in your feet, and you get that sudden, forceful release of sexual tension. And for women, the muscles of the vagina contract, and the uterus also undergoes rhythmic contractions. And men may experience rhythmic contractions of the muscles at the base of the penis, and then hence ejaculation occurs. And some people experience a sexual flush over the entire body after sex during the resolution phase. The body slowly returns to its normal level of function. You're relaxed. It may help you to sleep. There's a general sense of well-being, and the intimacy is typically enhanced. Some women are capable of a rapid return to the orgasm phase. In other words, some women are multi-orgasmic, especially with further sexual stimulation, but men need recovery time after orgasm, and that's called the refractory period, where they cannot reach orgasm again. And that time period varies amongst men, and that typically lengthens as men advance in age. So there can be problems in your relationship, or there can be problems with the sexual response cycle, and it's important to understand this cycle. Now, one last thing, this particular linear model doesn't resonate with everybody, especially women. Dr. Rosemary Basson developed the responsive desire response cycle. And that is where you respond to your partner's advances when everything is good and healthy in the relationship. And you don't feel like having sex because you are tired, but you do accept your partner's advances and you enjoy it. And you are motivated to have sex. We call that responsive desire. Just important to understand that, since people get very little sex education, including physicians in medical school. So the more we can educate people at different ages of life, and even children, it's important to educate children about sexual health, and depending on their developmental age, age-appropriate sexual health education. About 400,000 Canadians suffer from constipation. This is so common. I always say in my clinical practice on the North Shore of Vancouver that 70% of people on the North Shore have constipation and the rest have diarrhea. Anyway, constipation is a condition in which you may have fewer than 3 bowel movements a week. You may have stools that are hard, dry, or lumpy, or stools that are difficult or painful to pass, or a feeling that not all the stool has passed. You may get some abdominal bloating. And you know, it's very important to address this because it can make you feel sluggish and it's quite frankly unhealthy. So you got to move things along. And the best way is to start regular exercise. That's really important. Also, ensure that you drink plenty of water and eat a healthy, fiber-rich diet. And those are the recommendations that I want to make to you tonight. So a couple of foods that you might want to add to your repertoire of menus out there in your Canadian households to increase the fiber are, one of them is raspberries, especially in this summer. They also give you a hit of calcium and vitamin C. So that's good too. You just don't want to make raspberry pie or raspberry tart, because then you're going to be adding the sugar and the fat. You know how I feel about those two things. Anyway, pears are another one. It's a very sweet fruit. It's packed with vitamins. You never think of pears. I always think of an apple, but I forget. And then I have a pear and it's amazing. Has antioxidants, has a lot of fiber and water that can help with constipation. And it is low calorie, about 60 calories. Another low cal food, as long as you don't add the butter, is popcorn. It is a fabulous Apple TV food or for you to sit and enjoy. And it's a healthy snack as long as it's on its own. And you know what? You can get used to eating it on its own. It's packed with fiber. Something else that I always think is high glycemic index, but it's not apparently, I'm not sure I trust that, is watermelon, because I do love it, especially in the summer when it's perfectly ripe. It doesn't have a lot of fiber, but it's 92% water. And that can also encourage a bowel movement. It has tons of nutrients, antioxidants that can help to protect your cells. It has vitamins A, B, and C, and lycopene, which can help shield you from UV rays, which we have quite often in the summer. Oatmeal is also just a great choice for breakfast because you'll be less hungry. It'll sustain you for a better part of the day. It's a good source of fiber. also the oats absorb lots of water, and that can help with digestion. And as you probably know, it can help with lower your bad cholesterol or your LDL. It gives you complex carbs, protein, calcium, and iron, so it's very healthy. Almonds are another great source of fiber, and you can add them to salads or desserts. You can have them with plain yogurt and then add some fruit in there for a nice healthy snack. And you can grind them if you're going to make a nice tasty pie filling or pastry dough just on special occasions. And there's also kale and spinach and collard greens and turnip greens. The turnip greens in particular are a staple of Southern cooking, but a lot of people serve them with ham hocks, or you can use smoked turkey wings to lower the salt and fat in your diet for a tasty meal. Potatoes also have a lot of fiber and have resistant starch, and this resists digestion, and some of it ends up in your large intestine where it helps good bacteria grow, and that helps with constipation as well. Anyway, let's end on the less than sexiest subject.
Thanks for listening to the Sunday Night Health Show podcast. You can subscribe, rate, or review on your favorite podcast app. And if you've got a question about your health, the nurse is always in. So email me, nursetalk@hotmail.com, and I just might answer your question anonymously, of course, on next week's show. For now, have a happy and healthy week.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
3 nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
Drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman.
They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.